Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. We're a venue for spoken word presentations in many forms. We feature writers, artists, storytellers, and thinkers recorded at events around Seattle, Washington. In 2013, the rollout of the Affordable Care Act on the healthcare.gov website became a debacle for the Obama administration. Senator Mitch McConnell said about it, "God only knows how much money they've spent, and it's a failure. You know, the government simply isn't going to be able to get this job done correctly." Beyond the causes of the launch failure, the story of the people who recovered the website is a key subject of this talk by Jennifer Palka. For Palka, the lessons of that epic failure and recovery serve as a guide to how technology can and must make government more efficient. Jennifer Palka is the founder and director of Code for America, a nonprofit organization that promotes technological solutions to government inefficiencies. She also served as Deputy U.S. Chief Technology Officer, concentrating on a program to create a U.S. equivalent to the U.K.'s successful government digital service. Jennifer Palka spoke at Town Hall Seattle on March 6, 2015. This talk was presented by Town Hall and University Bookstore as part of the Civics series. Thanks to Edward Wolcher for our recording. Here, Microsoft's Catherine Neal introduces Jennifer Palka.
Welcome, everyone. I am Catherine, and I am the Seattle Director of the Technology and Civic Engagement Group at Microsoft. The role of the Technology and Civic Engagement Group is to bring Microsoft's best people and resources together to help civic leaders and the communities that they serve. So in addition to Seattle, we have folks in San Francisco, San Jose, Chicago, Boston, and New York City, and those people were all hired and are active in just the past year, which gives you an idea of how dynamic the civic tech space is. In all of those cities, we work very closely with the Code for Seattle, Code for Seattle here, Code for America Brigades in other cities as well. And that's why we're thrilled to bring Jen Palka, the executive director and founder of Code for America, here to Seattle tonight. Code for America's mission statement is on the screen. It believes government can work for the people, by the people in the 21st century. Jen Palka has been the U.S. Deputy Chief Technology Officer in the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. She was in charge of the Game Developers Conference and Game Developer Magazine, and she ran Web 2.0 and Gov 2.0 events for TechWeb. Palka joins us tonight to discuss the way new technologies, apps, and transparency can lead to governments that better serve our communities. And she'll tell us how we, civic-minded, everyday American citizens, can use our skills and knowledge to help make that better government a reality. So please join me in giving a very warm Seattle welcome to Jen Palka.
Thank you so much, Catherine. Really appreciate it. It's Friday night, so we'll, make this a thing. Thanks a lot, Catherine. Thank you, everybody at Town Hall. And Microsoft has been a supporter of us actually very much in the beginning of Code for America, and now again, really helping us take what we're doing to the next level, so thank you so much. So Friday night and talking about government technology, you guys are really nice. Thank you for being here. It's not really a technical talk. What I want to do is sort of share a little bit about my perspective on civic technology, less about the apps and more kind of about what I think is really at stake when we think about government and how it interacts with citizens. In ways that we, many of us I know here probably work in the technology industry, and we probably don't always see what's truly at stake from the outside. So I want to tell that story through the lens of my sort of insane last year, which started out at this place. This is the Code for America offices in San Francisco, and I think we kind of intentionally look a lot like a tech startup in downtown San Francisco because that's basically what we are. Very much that open floor plan, crazy people everywhere. So I went to work there every day. I go there to work every day now also. But I took a year off, as Catherine said, and I instead went to work in this building, which has a very different architecture, a very different kind of feel. That fence there, that black fence, is the one that if you jump over it, you get shot by Secret Service. It's actually a beautiful, majestic old building. And while you think about the cultures in two buildings like that being wildly different, in fact, I think there's a lot more in common between these two spaces than there that's different. Why did I go to work in that building for a year? Because of this guy, amazing person named Todd Park, who until pretty recently was the Chief Technology Officer of the United States. He asked me to come because he had created a program that was modeled after our Code for America fellowship program. Here you probably know the Brigade program better. In many places of the country, people think about Code for America as this fellowship, this year where we take, it's a year of service essentially for people who are in the technology industry, not always developers, designers, product managers, but people who can ship product. We have them do a year of service with local governments. And Todd said, let's do the same thing in federal government. We'll have people do a year of service doing innovation in federal agencies. And I told Todd that I thought that was great and would be happy to be involved with it, but that there was probably something else that we needed to do in federal government. We are spending an enormous amount of money in this country on technology for government. I'm sorry these stats are totally outdated, but whether it's $172 billion or more or a little bit less than that, that's a lot of money. And the question is, what are we getting for those dollars? The kind of things people think of when they think of government technology are websites that look like this. This is one that I worked on when I was in D.C. I went to help out at Citizenship and Immigration because they were realizing that if there are such problems with our healthcare website, I wonder if the problems in scaling technologies, scaling systems in the event of immigration reform might also jeopardize those policies. So I went and worked with those guys. I mean, this is just typical. I think you understand what I mean. It's a lot of words. It's very off-putting. But there's links in here that go back to the page you're on. There's all sorts of crazy stuff. But that's not even the worst of it. The worst of it is that when people think about government technology, they actually usually think about this, about standing in line. I go to cocktail parties and I tell people I work in government technology and they go, oh my God, can you fix the DMV? It's the first thing out of everybody's mouth. And I'm like, well, we work with local governments, so I don't know how I can help you. But and there was actually a great thing on the news here about Washington State's DMV problems, great little TV piece the other day. But it drives people crazy and it makes people feel like government is incompetent. And when that happens, I think we have a lot of problem investing in this one thing that we're all supposed to do together, this idea of government. So the thing about this is that it's actually a solved problem. This is being fixed in other places around the world. In London, they had a $10 billion IT failure in their healthcare space in the National Health Service. $10 billion is a lot of money to spend on software. And they said, there's got to be a better way. This is happening over and over again. So they hired a really fantastic guy named Mike Bracken, who was the head of digital for The Guardian, so consumer tech. And they said, you know what, you're in charge now. All IT for the UK government rolls up into you now. He hired a fantastic team. In fact, that person in the middle in the yellow shirt now works for us at Code for America. Amazing team of people, primarily from the consumer tech industry. And they just started doing things very, very differently. They started with this, which is a lot of you are going to go, oh, really? They started publishing content on a basic website? That's not radical. But it actually was. They didn't just port content from other sites onto some new content management system. They said, you know what? What the people need to know is not what we're serving them up. They threw out most of the content, and they put it all in one place. And it really actually has been fantastic. And then they said, now that we've sort of fixed publishing, let's all go fix the transactions that people have with government. This is an example of one. And it's not just that it runs on a more modern tech stack. It's that the interface itself is simple and beautiful and easy to use. It's a few clicks for you to apply for carer's allowance, which is something we don't have here, but it's a benefit, financial benefit that you get if you're taking care of elderly people in your home or something like that. It's a British thing. And they've done a fantastic job of that. So they fixed publishing. They're fixing the transactions. And they have far more users than they had when they started this project. They have much, much happier users. The funny story is they tell us they had to They'd never before had a feedback. They'd had feedback buttons on their websites before that always said, you know, well, what is your complaint? And they realized they had to add a button for compliments and thank yous because so many people wanted to thank them for such a great web experience. So happier users, more users, and they're spending about a sixth of what they had previously. Not 10% less, a sixth. So this is a solved problem, and in order to really do it, I pitched to Todd, if you want me to come to D.C., we need a U.S. version of this. We need the United States Digital Service, not just the government digital service. Todd said, I think you're crazy, but okay, we'll try this out. I showed up in D.C. in June of 2013, and we got to work on it. It was, at that point, a whole lot of PowerPoints to a whole lot of leaders and executives in government, and a whole lot of planning sessions, and we were getting moving on it, and then October 1st rolled around, and this happened. Does everybody remember this? I didn't have anything to do with healthcare.gov. Todd didn't really have much to do with healthcare.gov before this happened, but when the site failed and the president realized that his key policy initiative was in jeopardy, he pulled Todd out of OSTP, and he disappeared from my world for several weeks. And was asked to sort of make this thing work at all, you know, at whatever cost. What did Todd do? He pulled together a fantastic team of folks, some of whom are pictured on this Time magazine cover when they wrote about it. One of them there in the Snoopy t-shirt is Mikey Dickerson, who came out of Google. Mikey sort of informally led a team of folks from all over who came on very short notice. I think Mikey got a call on a Tuesday night and was on a plane like Wednesday afternoon out to D.C. and started working like Thursday morning. His team kind of duct taped together the site that they had and made it work and got it through that first open enrollment period, which was October through April. Next to him is Jeannie Kim, who separately had a team that ended up being about 13 people who worked all in one tiny windowless conference room in Columbia, Maryland, that would just get very stuffy. Those 13 people rebuilt healthcare.gov from the ground up in about 3 months. So what the federal government had spent up until launch at least $600 million to build, her 13 folks did in about 3 months. That $600 million, I mean, don't quote me on what healthcare.gov cost. Nobody knows, I guarantee you, certainly not me, but it cost a lot more than $600 million if you start counting what was spent after October 1st. These are, you know, one of the things I really want to stress about these folks who I had the really privilege of working alongside. I did not work on healthcare.gov. I was working on the other stuff at the time, but these folks were in my office, is that they're really true American heroes. Mikey was a subcontractor to a subcontractor, the prime contractor, working hourly. And at one point, we looked at his time cards, and he had worked 20 hours a day for 100 days straight. Yeah, and I think Jeannie Kim and her team were doing about the same thing. I mean, they basically didn't sleep. Todd didn't sleep, I think, for those couple of months. And you have to ask yourself, why does somebody do something like that? And I'll tell you why, because I would be in the office when Todd would come in from the president's office where they were going through the letters that people were sending in about the ACA. And these letters would really break your heart. And there were a lot of them that really profoundly affected a lot of us. But the one that I remember the most was from a mom who wrote in and said, I've spent the last 15 years having to choose between healthcare for myself and healthcare for my kids. And last night, I finally got through that site, and I'm signed up for health insurance for the first time, and I'm going to go see a doctor. And I don't think that's something most of us worry about every day. And when you said to Mikey, why are you doing this? He said, because I want my fellow Americans to have healthcare. And if this website doesn't work, ACA is toast. And I think that's really remarkable. I want to also mention that while I think all of these folks are real American heroes, I think there's a lot of them. One of them actually lives here in Seattle, the woman who was the CTO of the VA, a woman named Marina Martin, who probably some of you know. I don't think she ever sleeps either because she believes. I used to say this about Todd. Todd's afraid that if he sleeps, people will die. Marina Fraser is afraid of the same thing because it's true. Because if they don't fix those problems, people, veterans are dying every day. And so we have an amazing group of, very large group of people, most of whom I don't know, who truly are working their butts off every single day to make this stuff work. And we don't generally see it and we don't applaud it, and I wish we did that more. One of the times I was at the office late at night when they were talking about these letters, and the guys were going back to the operations center in Columbia, Maryland about 1 o'clock in the morning, and I said to them, why are you going back now? I mean, there's got to be very little traffic in the site in the middle of the night. And they said, actually, no, there's a ton of traffic on healthcare.gov in the middle of the night. And it's on the site, it's not from desktops, it's from low-end smartphones. The pattern that they saw is that people were waking up in the middle of the night, accessing the site through low-end smartphones, kind of that don't have a regular service plan on them, getting about two steps further along in the process, saving their work, and then going back later. That's how most people ended up getting through this site during this very, very rocky period when the folks were trying to fix it. And hold that thought about people doing stuff like this in the middle of the night, because that came back to me later when I was back at Code for America. The thing you got to know is that, of course, this was, frontline news for so long because it was the president's policy initiative. But that kind of broken technology, those kind of broken websites, broken digital services, while this was a time when a lot of middle-class people had to experience what was going on with healthcare.gov, as Ezra Klein very brilliantly wrote, if you're poor in America, you have a healthcare.gov on your hands every single day. And I'll talk more about that when we talk about food stamps. So I think there's this underlying anxiety, not just about what we put poor people through in this country, but about the fact that if we can actually almost lose a policy, a law that the president spent 3 years fighting to get because we can't make a website work, I think that we are at the place where we have to think about, can we actually govern if we cannot implement the policies that we create? That was a complicated website. No, certainly not to diminish it in any way, but the community here in Seattle and Redmond could have done this, and in fact, many of them did contribute to it. Just one more thing about healthcare.gov. When it failed, I thought back to this blog post that had been written in. This was back in February 2012. By a guy named Tom Steinberg. He runs an organization in the UK that I kind of called like the predecessor of Code for America. It's called My Society. It has nothing to do with healthcare.gov, but back in February of 2012, he was writing about a colleague of his named Chris Lightfoot, who was an absolute genius and a polymath. He could have done anything in the world with his life, but he chose to devote his particular talents to government technology, to civic technology. And unfortunately, his colleague Chris had died, and he was writing a blog post memorializing this guy. And he says in the course of it, what Chris fundamentally had right is the understanding that you can no longer run a country if the elites don't understand tech in the same way that they grasp economics or ideology or propaganda. I don't think we've totally realized that in D.C. yet, but it is absolutely true. And he says if they don't learn. He had these predictions that were savage and depressingly accurate. And I think that prediction was Chris Lightfoot and Tom Steinberg calling out that we were going to have a healthcare.gov, that we were going to have a moment that we can't actually implement the policies and laws that we pass. I think it's really important that we understand the role of a basic understanding of the digital world in our ability to have a functioning democracy and what he says he calls good governance and good society. And I want you guys to think about your role in that as we talk. So that moment of being, of an understanding of what it's like if you don't have health insurance in this country really reminded me of what happened when I came back to Code for America. So I spent a year there. When I left for D.C., this team was in the middle of working with the city and county of San Francisco. This is a team of fellows working with Ed Lee, our mayor, wonderful mayor in San Francisco. They asked the fellows there to work on a particular problem, which is churn in the food stamps program. So CalFresh is our state's supplemental nutrition program. And they had realized in San Francisco is that a lot of people can, the people do sign up for the program, not as many as we'd like. But once they sign up for it, a very large percentage of people then very quickly fall off the rolls. They're enrolled, and somehow then they're not enrolled. And that's very expensive, and they wanted the fellows to look into this problem. So the first thing that they did, because we have a very bottom-up sort of user-centered way of doing this, is they actually enrolled in CalFresh. And what they found is that enrollment is not easy. This is part of the 50-page process that you go through just to submit an application. It ends with a button asking you to print it, which I don't understand who they think you're going to print it. So it's a little bit crazy. Then, by the way, you get a phone call and they ask you all the same questions. But once you're enrolled, you, as the fellows found out, you start getting these notices in the mail. And I'm going to force you to listen to this for a second. So this is from an actual notice that we got. They were all like this, by the way. We didn't pick a particularly bad one. Your food stamp benefits in this quarter did not change as a result of the document/information we received because it would not have resulted in an increase in benefits. Your food stamp benefits in this quarter did not change as a this is all the same letter, by the way. Did not change as a result of the documents and information we received because the new rule says that when you report some changes, the county cannot lower your food stamps until the next quarter. The county has refigured your food stamps using the information you reported, and the food stamp amount did not go up. What are they talking about? Nobody knows, right? So you would get a letter like this, and what you didn't know when you read the whole thing, if you could read the whole thing, because many people just stop, is that they're asking you to send in some more documentation. It's probably proof, it could be proof of that your income is the same, it could be proof of residency, it's a whole range of things. But why do people fall off the rolls? Because they can't understand what they're asking for here. And I mean, our fellows are like, this is our job. We've like dedicated our entire year to fixing this problem, and we can't understand these notices. They also, by the way, come to you in the mail, and most people, it turns out, just don't, a lot of people don't get their mail. We can talk about that. But the moment that the fellows really tuned into is sort of an emotional crux of this is this moment. So you think you're on food stamps, and you get this little thing that looks like a credit card. It's an EBT card, electronic benefit transfer card. And you go shopping, and you have all of your groceries, and you're at the front of the line, and you swipe your card, and it doesn't work. That happens to people all over California every day when we're focused on California. And it's not just that it's humiliating, because everyone behind you in line is going, It's also that you're hungry. So most EBT is spent after midnight on Wednesdays, because the cards get charged up on Wednesday at midnight. So who goes shopping at midnight? People who are hungry. Who goes on healthcare.gov in the middle of the night? People who need health insurance. This is why these guys decided to do this, the same way that Mikey and Jeannie decided to do what they were doing, because they met these people and realized that we are failing them. What did they do about it? They said, oh, well, first they tried making a website that explained the notices and nobody went there. They tried about 4 dozen things. They measured the results of everything they do. We have an iterative, user-centered, and data-driven process. And they finally landed on something that, while very difficult, did work. They started collecting cell phone numbers of EBT recipients, and they started texting them when they were out of compliance. Your CalFresh benefits may stop at the end of this month. Questions, call this number. This was really, really hard because they didn't have any cell phone numbers for CalFresh recipients, and the law, it appeared that there was a policy prohibiting that. They had to get that changed. Then they had to actually start collecting these numbers, and then they had to do a trial. But in the trial, they found that 40% fewer people fell off the rolls when they got this text message, which is fantastic. But the folks that were working on this, when I came back from service and federal government, had their fellowship year had ended 6 months earlier. And Jake Solomon, who was sort of one of the leads on this project in with the City and County of San Francisco, had decided to keep working on it despite the fact that we were no longer paying him. And two of his other colleagues from different teams had also gotten so upset about what they had found out in working on this that they also decided to just keep working with us. Alan Williams actually had no income at all so that he could be on food stamps and be on other social services and have the full experience of it. And they wanted to make the process better. So a couple of things that they found. Because of that crazy application process I showed you early, there's at least 3.5 million people who are eligible I'm sorry, just California stats. I know I'm in Washington. Who are eligible for CalFresh but not getting it because it's so hard to apply. When people do get the benefits, they get these EBT cards, and if they use them at ATMs, they get charged fees because they don't know which ones have no fees. And then when you get that text message saying, call us, you're going to fall off the rolls, you're on hold for 45 minutes, okay? If you are the working poor, if you have kids, you probably, A, don't have a cell phone with an unlimited cell phone minutes plan, and you don't have 45 minutes to be on hold. And what they saw was that while these are each individually maybe small things, they really add up. They add up to a really, really bad experience and to just a very poor quality of life. They talked about this moment that they saw in one of the enrollment offices where they said, this is exactly right. It's a guy using a pencil that's too short to fill out a form on a wall that isn't even flat. This is the in-person version of what we put people through digitally when they're asked, when they want social services from our country. So they said, look, we're going to try to make this better. And they were just doing this honestly in their own spare time. Instead of this, they said, let's try this. This. There you go. So this is working on any smartphone. It doesn't have to be an iPhone or anything fancy. It's about 7 steps. And in the end, you can sign with your finger and hit submit. You're not enrolled yet, but you have applied. That's a lot better. If you're trying to figure out where you can use your EBT card, instead of a long, complicated process with all these drop-down menus, you can just open up an app. It'll show you what's nearby while you use it. That moment at the checkout stand, when you don't know if your EBT card's going to work, they made it really easy for you to text in your EBT card number, and it'll tell you how much you have on your card. And then that biggie, that 45 minutes on hold, they basically just did a basic callback thing. Text in, we'll call you back when there's somebody ready to talk to you. And the great thing is when we showed this to the folks in San Francisco City and County, sorry, that's them calling. We have somebody on the line. The director of social services for City and County of San Francisco said, I love this. Only thing is my voice needs to be the one that you record so that when the social worker's phone rings, they have to hear, hi, this is Leo O'Farrell. You have a client on the other line. Please hold so they won't hang up. So we have great support from the inside, even though all this stuff is sort of happening from the outside. So these folks have just been really pioneering for us. Kind of our new thing, which is like not just doing stuff through the fellowship, but having these labs where people can just experiment on this outside of government, throw great solutions over the wall. And actually, now this team has been asked to come work with the State Department of Social Services State Department of Social Services of California. They have a $500 million COBOL system. Anyone know what COBOL is? That runs eligibility, and they're going, this probably isn't a great idea. Can you help us find another solution? So it's great. We're kind of moving up into state government so that can filter back down to the 32 California counties. And it's exciting work. It's not just, of course, social services that matter, right? I mean, we have to deal with government in a lot of different ways. Anybody here own a small business? Anybody had not loved the paperwork that they've had to fill out? Yeah, right. So, in fact, this is great. You know, we think that what bothers people about government is taxes. If you actually survey people, what they care about is they need to know if they're in compliance. You don't know what forms you're supposed to fill out. You don't know what's supposed to be paid when. Lots of small businesses, especially those that can't afford expensive lawyers, live in fear of being out of compliance in some way. And everything looks like that. It's these long forms that you've got to fill out. So an example of an app that we did in this space, actually, we didn't do this. I take it back. This came out of one of our Code for America fellows that started his own business. This is called Zoning Check. It works in certain cities where they've got it hooked up. But basically, instead of trying to read the zoning code and figure out if you can locate your business there, it just walks you through where are you trying to locate, what kind of business, do you have a location picked out? No, just show me the map, I want to know. So this is Palo Alto, Palo Alto, California. That's where you can put an office in Palo Alto. It's basically along University Avenue there. Make something that would take you hours otherwise, just super, super easy. This work came out of this guy, Joel Mahoney, who was in our first class of Code for America Fellows. He was working with the city of Boston. And during that year, the mayor came to him and said, we really need you guys to move off the project you're on. We have a big problem. we changed the rules about how kids are assigned to public schools. And it's basically a mapping problem. The policy was written to help kids be able to walk to school. We want kids to be about a mile and a half, you know, less than a mile and a half from school to home so they can walk. But the problem is that we have printed this amazing 28-page printed brochure and sent it to all the parents. And none of them can figure out which school their kids are eligible to attend. Shocker. And parents were furious. There was this thing in the Boston Globe that had a video of parents crying, actually. And so Joel sort of calved off from the team that was working on some other projects there. In about 10 weeks, he put up something called Discover BPS, which is very simple. You type in your name, your address, and the grade of your kids. And if you have a sibling, this is the other business logic, if there's a sibling in another school, you can add that. And it will return, and I'm sorry, I don't have a screenshot of it, will return a mapped list of schools your kid can attend in about 10 seconds. It's very easy, a couple seconds. So the thing about that application is it kind of set one of the patterns for Code for America. Just make something that's a little complex, very, very easy. But this was the first time that we heard this. So we showed this to the folks in Boston and said, I hope this is good. They said, we love this, fantastic. Did you know that if this had gone through regular channels, which means a procurement process, it would have taken about 2 years and cost about $2 million? We did not know that at the time. Now we know that very, very well. But this is a great example. Those are all great examples of what I like to think of as the for the people part of our mission. But I want to talk for a second about the by the people part. We take this pretty seriously. These are fellows in our second year who were asked, I know, big burden, to go to Honolulu for the year. I visited them twice, I have to admit. They were asked to work on the city's website. In fact, they said many times, look, we cannot work on Honolulu.gov. It's like 20,000 web pages. It's not backed by any particular CMS. It's just stuff. And there is no way that three people in the course of 10 months are going to be able to fix this problem. The people kept saying, no, we really need to do this. Please go look at this. Of course, you can see this as sort of a typical circa 2011 kind of website. It's really what government wants to tell citizens. These drop-down menus over here, I spent a lot of time on the site, never worked. I mean, you could click on them and they would do something, but they didn't actually take you to a Twitter feed. And it's organized by government thinking, right? So the fellows said, look, we can't fix your website, but let's at least dive into this problem a little bit. Let's look at your search logs. What are people trying to do when they come to Honolulu.gov? Turned out that the first search term, the most common, this is vehicle, do you have a license? The biggest thing people were looking to do is actually get a driver's license, which sounds crazy because most of us know that that's a state function. Actually, in Honolulu has some like very large percentage of the state's population. So the city and county of Honolulu actually does handle driver's license functions there. So they said, okay, if that's the main thing people are coming for, let's type that search term into Honolulu.gov and see what we get. So you get a page about like this. Click on one of those links, you're going to get a page about like this. In fact, there's about 20, 25 pages that look like this. It's a lot of information about driver's licenses. One of the pages actually talks about the new machines that they bought that print the driver's licenses. This page tells you about things like that if you're a member of the armed forces, you have a grace period after you come back. Great, lovely. None of the pages tell you how to get a driver's license. So they said, look, we can't fix the website, but let's do a prototype project here. And they remember the gov.uk thing I showed earlier? The team borrowed that, essentially, and built this called Honolulu Answers. And they mocked up at first just the first 10 most popular questions people were trying to answer when they came to Honolulu.gov, and they put them in the system. So if you type driver's license into this, you will get this. How do I get a driver's... And I think I'm mixing the next slide. I'm sorry, I dropped a couple slides. If you click on that third link there, how do I get a driver's license for the first time, it will take you to a page that gives you the four simple steps. Here's where you go, here's what you need to bring, and here's how you can schedule an appointment. Fantastic. That's what people want to know. And it's just really modeling what we wanted to do with the site. But again, we had three people. We had, at that point, probably 7 months left. What are they going to do? Everyone here heard of a hackathon? They did not hold a hackathon. They held what I think was the first civic write-a-thon. They took the next 70 most asked questions from the site, and they put them on little sticky notes or cut out pieces of paper on the wall in a co-working space about a block and a half from City Hall on a Saturday morning, and they invited all the people that they had been talking to over the course of the past couple of months. About 60 people showed up. They were people from about maybe a little bit less half government, and then the rest of them just people they'd been talking to who cared about this thing working. And they showed up, and all day long they sat there and they wrote simple, clear answers to those 70 questions. There were enough people from government that they could check stuff, and they could check stuff off official websites. And at the end of the day, they had, the 70 or 80 most important or most common questions that people were asking in this amazing sort of site alongside Honolulu.gov. But even more importantly, this crazy thing happened. They had a fantastic time. It turned into this great party. The mayor showed up, and they were all laughing, and they created a community of people who cared about this. And you just don't really think about government websites and, like, crazy fun all-day parties in the same thought, generally. But that's really what happened here. And what's, though, there's the mayor then changed, and there's been less support for it in the government. This community group continues to meet. They're part of the Code for America Brigade in Honolulu, that community kind of existed as a part of this. And they continue to make this stuff better and better all the time, whether there's support from government or not. And I think that's really remarkable. So the lessons we sort of derive from that is that, yes, it is possible for interfaces to government to be simple, beautiful, and easy to use, like Honolulu Answers. But also, and we've got to talk about this, right? It's participating in government isn't just complaining that the website is broken. It's helping to fix it yourself, saying, yes, I will be part of the solution. I can offer not just my voice, my complaints, but my hands. There's another lesson, though, because now there are answers in lots and lots of cities around the country. This was me. I put this one up in Oakland. I keep chickens. And everyone always says, oh, you can keep chickens in Oakland? Absolutely, you can keep chickens in Oakland. You cannot keep roosters. They're very loud. You don't want them. But we have an Oakland Answers that's got about 150, 200 questions on it now that really simplify the user experience for folks in Oakland. And many, many other cities do that as well, and they've all done the same thing. It's a day, a write-a-thon, and then a community that follows up on it. And I think that's really important because we talked about that two-year, $2 million procurement process for something that only needed to take a couple months. It is possible for solutions in government to sort of come from anywhere and to spread the way things actually spread on the internet. It just we have to be part of that process to make that happen. You guys should know that this is government by the people. This is our brigade program, which I mentioned earlier. There are brigades that meet weekly in city halls or in other community spaces around the country, all over the country. I'm very active, somewhat active with Code for Oakland. But you knew this was coming. You have one here. And these guys are right here, Code for Seattle. Yes. Hi, stand up. This is Seth and Will. And they run Code for Seattle. They held a great Seattle Open Day today a couple weeks ago when we had our Code Across America event. And they meet Thursdays, sometimes at Socrata and sometimes at the Impact Hub. I should remember that. We have an Impact Hub in Oakland, too. So you should go. That's the point. You should go. And one of the things they've been involved with, and we were talking about just before this event, is this, and probably guys know this, there's this thing with the video cameras. Raise your hand if you know what I'm talking about. Okay, most people do, good. This is a great example of government by the people, right? Someone says, we need to release all of the video that's coming from the police department video cams as the cops are out there in the field, but the police department doesn't really have the resources to redact all that video, so we're not actually showing the faces of people who don't really want to be on YouTube or whatever. And so they, instead of saying, sorry, we can't do that, Mike Wagers says, you know what, why don't we ask the community to help us solve this problem? How will we redact this video so that we can release it? they hold a hackathon. The guy who has filed all of these complaints actually shows up and is the person who's decided to actually has the best solution to the problem that he created. It's amazing. This is government by the people in a way that I think our founding fathers and mothers maybe didn't quite anticipate, but I think it's what they meant. I really do. So I'm talking about this idea of voices, not hands, but now I want to get back to voices. So we do still really need to have better ways of hearing what people want. Civic dialogue can be very broken. We're in something called town hall. Town halls are awesome, but town hall also is often dominated by the voices of people who feel that they have access, that they can talk. This is a process in Philadelphia when they were doing their 2035 plan. What they do when you're doing a city plan now is that there's like, it's Thursday nights generally, in City Hall. They say, come and be part of this process. We've got maps. The same set of people generally show up to these things every time. And they generally, just to be frank, are older white people. In Philadelphia, what they needed to hear from was not older white people. They had specific questions about lower income communities, about communities of color. And those people were not going to show up on Thursday night and mark up maps, or at least they weren't showing up at Thursday night and marking up maps. So the Code for America fellows there built something called Textizen, which actually the major interface to Textizen is posters. They put posters around the city that ask the specific questions those planners were asking. So if you saw this one about would you use a rail line along Boulevard to get to City Center, it's because you were at that bus stop or you were at that rail stop. So they knew if you were answering that question exactly where you were standing. There was one about where do you shop for groceries? They put those posters specifically in neighborhoods that they knew were food deserts. So they know that they're getting answers to the questions from the people who are actually in those neighborhoods. And then people would text in their answers and they could have this great sort of summary of it. It's like this is now one of our civic startups. They are working with hundreds of cities and health communities around the country. And actually, it looks a lot better now, I feel bad, but it also tabulates all the information for the folks automatically, so they're not sort of trying to bring us all together. These are sort of some of the Code for America, I want to return, because I kind of left the healthcare.gov story when it was like really, really, really bad. It didn't stay terrible, as this headline shows. It was slightly less terrible every day. We were very proud of that headline. We celebrated that one. And at the end, actually, more people enrolled in healthcare through healthcare.gov than we even thought was possible before the site broke. An amazing, amazing achievement. So it's a really happy ending in a lot of ways. But the happier ending even for me is that Mikey stayed on to run that United States Digital Service, which is now working to sort of fix not just specific sites, but the model on which we create government technology at the federal level. Working in concert with us who work at the local level, and he does go to work in that T-shirt. And the president thinks that's super cool, and it's all awesome. And if he wears a button-down shirt, it has to be wrinkled, and it's sort of the thing that's going on there, which is great. Part of what we did at the U.S. Digital Service was ship something we called the USDS Playbook, and there's a bunch of things you might call out on this. It's at CIO, playbook.cio.gov. Number four, build the service using agile and iterative practices. I'm quite proud of, and that took a lot of work working with the Office of Federal Procurement Policy. But I want you to look at number one, understand what people need. That's how we start this process when we do it right. Here is the Government Digital Service in the UK, their design principles. You're going to notice a pattern here. It starts with start with needs. What's that asterisk about? The asterisk says user needs, not government needs. Out of everything that the UK has done to transform the way they do technology, hiring Mike Bracken, getting incredible support from the top, changing the vendor ecosystem, all of that is secondary because what they did was they got everybody aligned around that. They said, that's what we're doing. We're meeting user needs. And then at Code for America, we have our principles for 21st century government. And guess what? They start with design for people's needs. This is actually the secret sauce of government technology that works. It's not any particular vendor. It's not any particular methodology. It's not any particular tech stack. It's people. And that's why we say government can work for the people, by the people, echoing the language of our founding fathers and mothers. But if you talk to the folks who do this work, whether it's Jake Solomon working on the Promptly app, or Mikey, or the folks here at Code for Seattle, they will tell you that it's government working for people, actual real people who need our help, and by people, actual real people who show up at write-a-thons and show up at Code for Seattle and show up and, you know, at the hackathon and write the algorithm to blur out the faces. This is what it's actually really about. Moving forward at Code for America, we're working primarily in these three areas: health, economic development, and safety and justice. That work with the food stamps is sort of the cornerstone of our health work. We are increasingly working with police departments and would love to work with Seattle. We had a great meeting with them today. And that economic development work that I showed you around permitting and zoning is sort of the foundation of that work. Right now, we've got 8 teams of 3 fellows each in these cities: Pittsburgh, Miami, Albuquerque, Richmond, West Sacramento, Somerville, Indianapolis, and Vallejo. Those last two, by the way, we're working with the police department. So when I meet with your police department here, it's a lot of the same story. We could talk about that in Q&A if you want. But I just spent some time with our Indianapolis team, who's been doing ride-alongs with the police department there. And again, the experience that you have when you're actually doing this work is really an experience of understanding it's not the way you, this is not the Richard Scarry world of the, the cops are catching bank robbers and the fire department is putting out fires. What cops do these days is social work and taxi driver and ambulance work, and that's what they saw. They also saw in 10 ride-alongs, no police, they didn't see a single cop finish filling out a form. The forms are so long, and they're mostly digital forms, and the interfaces are terrible. They can't file the reports. That's why the data is so bad. That's that bottom-up vision, that bottom-up understanding of what's actually going on in the streets is really different from what we think. We did this work in, we started this work in the safety and justice area because the Arnold Foundation had come to us and talked to us about how they can see by the data that we are holding too many people pre-trial. We are have too many bench warrants out for people in many communities in the country. Do you guys know what a bench warrant is? So that's the thing that you get, like if you get a traffic ticket but you don't go to court to deal with it, and it becomes actually, then somehow you're actually going to be arrested for having run a red light. They were explaining to me back in 2012 that it's these things that are glomming up our criminal justice system that are creating enormous inequalities, because it's the people who can't take a day off work to go stand in line to pay a ticket who are getting those bench warrants. And then when Ferguson happened, and I saw this in the New York Times, and I saw that Ferguson had 1,500 bench warrants per 1,000 people, which is crazy. And I said, oh my God, the people at the Arnold Foundation are absolutely right. This is an indicator of a complete lack, a complete breakdown of civil society when we're doing that. And there is no app in the world that is going to combat institutional racism. But when we can go say, hey, let's make it easier for people to clear a bench warrant, or to clear a traffic ticket so they don't get a bench warrant, these are the little things that you and I and everybody here can do to help avoid a Ferguson. I know that's a stretch, but I think it's important that we think that way. So I want to end on this. Government can work for the people by the people in the 21st century, but only if we make it so. And we don't mean we, Code for America. We mean we, everybody. We mean it as we, the people. And so I would ask that all of you here think about your responsibility as a citizen to make government work. If you have a background in the technology industry, I would think about going to this URL and telling us if you ever have any interest in working in government, whether it's as a Code for America fellow or at the United States Digital Service. Just let us know you're thinking about it. We might follow up with you. And at the very minimum, go to our sign-up page and be on our email list so that we can stay in touch with you. I would be very happy to answer questions, and we've got mics here. And thank you so much for listening to my rant about government technology. Someone Someone's got to have a question. Okay, great.
I had three short questions. Do you think Mitch McConnell can write any code?
Do I think Mitch McConnell can write code?
Yeah.
I have no idea, but I don't write code either, so I don't really want to call it.
I noticed these guys are really critics, but they couldn't, you know, I don't think they had a clue how to fix a website.
No, I don't think that they were very helpful.
Do you find it ironic that the Supreme Court could make all this effort moot if they come down with a certain decision?
Ironic isn't the word I'd use, but I think that would be a tragedy.
Yeah. And then the last question is, what is your formal education experience? I was curious how you got to where you are.
If you're asking if I have a technology background, I don't. I studied American Studies in college, and I... Yes! The most useless degree ever! I actually worked in social services right out of college, which is why I think these issues around the social safety net really... matter to me a lot, but I found it, frankly, really, really difficult to work in social services and ended up sort of taking the easy way out and working in the technology media for many, many years and, found my way back, to, I guess, to social services in a way. Thanks. Chris? Oh, okay, we're going to trade off.
Excellent talk.
Thank you.
And probably the first town hall lecture I've seen from someone not trying to sell me a book.
I should write a book. Then I'll sell it to you.
So you mentioned the importance of getting the government leaders to understand the significance of technology and all.
Yeah.
But what I'm wondering about is, I guess, the opposite problem. I went to tech school, and, I mean, among we computer science majors graduating, it was all sort of, oh, are you going to work for Google, Microsoft, etc., or a startup? And, I mean, it was, like, government stuff and all, that wasn't even an option. I mean,
yep.
Some of that might just be, like, government doesn't pay as much, you don't get stock options, that sort of thing. But, I mean, some of it's also just, I don't know, government work isn't considered sexy. It's, I mean,
right.
How do you remedy that? How, I mean, you can come and talk to us, but we're a small group. How do you change the perception culturally on a larger scale?
We're going to try. That's all I got. So one of the things Mikey and actually a bunch of others who came in to help save the site said was they ended up recruiting other folks from, you know, their peer groups by saying, you will get more experience in a week on healthcare.gov than you would in a year at Google or Microsoft because so much happens. And you will care a lot about what you do. So they have been amazingly articulate about the value, the emotional value, the professional value of working in that particular circumstance, which we hope is somewhat unique. I recruited a guy into the VA who I saw a couple weeks ago, and he was like, oh, Jennifer, what you have done to me. This is so by far the hardest job I've ever had. And I thought he was going to kill me, and he's like, this is the most amazing thing that's ever happened to me. I wake up every day and feel like I'm saving lives. And it's really, really difficult. But, I can't thank you enough for strong-arming me into doing that. I think we just have to tell those stories more. And I do think we need to figure out how to make government sexy. Yeah. And if you've got any concrete ideas, talk to
you after.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Chris.
Well, for a second there, I was concerned he was going to steal my question.
Okay.
But if you're a techie, and a lot of us in the audience here are techies, and you want the most impactful way you can help government do better in tech,
mm-hmm.
What are a few things you can do? Is it going to in digital service? Is it a PIF? Is it hackathons? What are the best things that we can do to help?
All of the above. I think start small. Start by going to Code for Seattle. Start by going to hackathons. Start by playing with data sets that the government releases. And then when you just can't get enough, think about doing something. So there's sort of the, like, what you can do in an evening. There's sort of what you can do in a couple of months. Code for America Fellowship is 11 months long. That's a great way to sort of get started and sort of get exposure to government context. And then, you know, when you're ready to take the plunge, going into government doesn't need to be going to D.C., though in your case, we want it to be. But, we have a position open right now, and I can't remember the exact title, but, you know, I talked about all that work with social services in San Francisco. They're hiring for, like, the new director of technology who's going to run all of those systems. We get the right person in that job, all of our work is suddenly 4 times easier than it would be otherwise. That's not a job that Todd Park is going to recruit for, but that's a job I'll recruit you for. That's an incredible job. You will save lives. You will make sure that people are getting food. You will help kids who are in foster care. I mean, it's like a super, super amazing job. Yasha Franklin Hodge took the job of CIO of Boston. He was one of the founders of Blue State Digital. It was a platform that was sort of largely credited with electing the president in 2008. He's doing an amazing job. So it's, you know, I think work your way up to a full-time job in government. You will have enormous impact. Get your toes wet in the brigades and in other things.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Over here.
Hi. Yeah, thank you so much for your talk. My name is Candace Faber, and I get to hang out a lot on the civic tech scene here, even though, like you, I'm not a technologist by background. I actually used to work for the federal government. I was a Foreign Service officer with the State Department. And I ultimately left not because I didn't believe in the mission, but because of the culture and the attitude kind of against innovation, which I found really, really stifling. And in coming here and doing very similar kind of civic engagement, community engagement work, I found that there's no shortage of incredibly talented people who are deeply concerned about civic and social problems and more than willing to lend their energy to solve those problems. That said, I think we've kind of hit a ceiling, at least from my perspective, with what we can do with the current sort of state of open data and with volunteer labor. Mm-hmm. There's a lot you can do in a weekend. Mm-hmm. There's a lot you can do for free. But maintaining software on an ongoing basis, mm-hmm. solving problems, developing relationships, and in particular, developing relationships with the communities that need technology the most, is not something that I think any of us can really just kind of throw away our day jobs and do full time. So knowing that you've worked on this problem in a lot of ways, I'm really curious if you can kind of speak to your insights, maybe more specifically from Oakland, to those of us who are trying to create a more sustainable ecosystem around civic tech here in Seattle with the grassroots approach?
That's a great question. And there isn't an easy answer to it. I think some of the most sustainable stuff I've seen is where people have built businesses around it. So we have 7 companies that have spun off from Code for America. Text is in, OpenCounter or two that I showed here, but their Transit Mix is a great new one. And they have an announcement that's not until Monday, so I can't say it here. And that's right. I mean, that's a huge leap saying I'm going to try to actually, you know, build this and sell it. But, in some cases it's really worked. I think on a volunteer basis, it's interesting you say you feel like we kind of hit a ceiling. My observation, and I mean this in the most positive possible way, is that, what they did in the UK was they said, we're going to do it this way. We're going to fix publishing, which is not sexy and anyone here is not wanting to do. Then we're going to fix transactions, and then we're going to go wholesale. That was their plan. Number 3. So they basically putting open data third. We put open data first. And what that means is that we're trying to support an open data ecosystem by exporting data, with the exception of Socrata, from crappy legacy systems that aren't sort of validating the data in any way. The UK now has said, okay, we've done number 1 and 2, now we're going to go do number 3, and we're going to do it sort of Amazon style, right, where the data feeds are already like great data feeds because the other parts of the business are already consuming them. And I think that makes for a more sustainable open data world because things are coming out just in a, you know, there's not this like constant cleaning of the data, dealing with sort of these crappy exports, no feeds. I'm not exactly sure what to do with it. I mean, the reality that we're in here in the United States is our reality. I think more people need to innovate on business models for sustainable open data businesses that are built on open data. We see, new ones every week, but I think for a lot of people still, it's a bit of a slog to maintain open data applications in such a way that doesn't feel like it's just going to eat up your life in a volunteer capacity. So I don't have an answer. Maybe Chris does.
We just have about 5 more minutes for questions. If you can keep them really quick, we'll get through as many as possible.
Hi. My question is more about your effort with the federal government. And mm-hmm. I was wondering if that effort is kind of keeping going past healthcare.gov and everything, and if so, in which areas the government wants to focus on improving technology, mm-hmm. and more specifically, if you know of any plan regarding more the immigration area that could be very, very much improved.
The immigration, so the United States Digital Service, there's actually a couple pieces of the overall innovation play that's going on in the federal government. USDS is actually in some ways the smallest piece, so they just got a giant increase in their budget in the president's new budget, which is great. 18F is the other place that I should mention, and I hope some of you have heard of it. That's a much, much larger group within the General Services Administration that has developers and designers. But the USDS has, I think, only 5 priorities now. Immigration is one of them. They're working very closely in hand with the folks there on a project called Transformation, which is basically digitizing the back-end process processing immigration status changes. When Mark Schwartz came in as CIO at CIS, Citizenship and Immigration Services, there was a $2 billion project underway for this transformation project, and he kind of wrestled that to the ground and said, it's not going to work as a $2 billion project. We're going to break it up into smaller bits and serve it out to agile vendors who are going to work with us in a fundamentally different way. And he deserves enormous credit for getting that back on track. Now the USDS is involved with it and helping to, I think, steer it in the right direction. It's going to be okay eventually. It's going to take a while.
Thank you.
And we're totally cheering for them. Yeah, thanks for giving a shout out to immigration. Sorry, I think I got over here. Yes.
Quick plug, our Seattle Code for America Brigade is working on a minimum wage calculator. See me if you want to help.
Woo!
And then a question, how can we get, you showed a 6x decrease in costs in UK based mm-hmm. on having better technology. Mm-hmm. How can we get government technology salaries to align closer to the private sector so people don't have to feel like they're taking a pay cut if they want to serve?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer. I do know that there are certain pay scales in federal government that allow for being off the GS scale. I will tell you, though, that of the people that we recruited, none of them cared about the salary. They, it was like, well, that's not really the big deal.
Have you considered that not people who don't care about salary may skew towards being male, may skew towards being white, and may skew towards being single?
That's definitely true, but I will tell you... I'll tell you that the makeup, I just visited my friends at the United States Digital Service, and they've done a demographic analysis of everybody's working at USDS under these conditions, and they say it almost exactly reflects the population of the United States, which means it's half female and it's half white. Yeah. So, and they care a lot about that. I do hear you on that point, though. It's a very hard problem to solve.
So it's funny to follow that question because I've been working process improvement private sector for about 8 years and thinking about going public sector. and I was inspired by some of your examples, and I wanted to know a pinch more about the Honolulu Answers mm-hmm. write-a-thon where you said that they teamed up but then didn't have government support and yet kept going. Can you say more about what support they lacked? Like did they write all this stuff and it didn't actually get published? Or what was the nature of it? And then mm-hmm. what kept it going and what's the benefit if they didn't have the support?
That's a great question. They actually had amazing support. The mayor was completely behind them and hung out with them all day and helped edit. But then he lost the election. And the new mayor, it just happens, right? New mayors, new whatevers are like, oh, that's the old thing. I'm the new thing. We're going to do something different. And so whereas when we left, there was sort of a process of how do we take this prototype then and have it sort of map back over to the actual Honolulu.gov site, that seemed to stop, at least as it connected to our efforts for a while when the new mayor came in. But actually do this exercise right now. Go to Honolulu.gov right now and look at it. It looks nothing like what it looked like. So it did have an impact. They've done an amazing refresh on Honolulu.gov that actually borrows from the content that we did, borrows from the interface and the design. And I think in the end it really did have a big impact. So it did affect the core site, but also, again, we have this amazing community there that continues to do all these great civic hacking projects and is just waiting to sort of, I think, be recognized by the next mayor.
Thank you.
And you don't need permission to put up a Honolulu.answers, right? You don't need permission, and you probably would. You've got a great administration here. But you don't need anybody to say yes or okay to doing Seattle Answers. You just do it, and you put it up. sorry, over here.
Yeah. I start this off by saying that I'm a big foe of things like hackathons and what have you in terms of software development, because to me they've always meant you're not well organized and you don't have process. And a lot of what you described is the sort of mimics the hero culture in a lot of software. We'll go in and fix it and what have you.
That's right.
That doesn't fix the underlying process issues.
No.
And is this going to help with them?
No, you're absolutely right. So Clay Shirky has this great line, the valuable output of any hackathon is not running code, but social connections. And that is generally what we see. It creates a community of people who are interested in solving a problem later. We actually hold very few hackathons because we can't sustain the code that generally comes out of it. So we're increasingly focused on getting people in deeply into a problem over a long period of time. I don't think that means that hackathons aren't valuable. They can do an amazing job of showing people who don't understand how technology works that something, you know, isn't as hard as it seems. They can do an amazing job of connecting people who want to solve a problem later. And frankly, they increasingly are doing an amazing job of having people understand the problem itself, even if they don't fix it. They're not going to fix it that day. But exposure to the actual problem is incredibly valuable.
But how do you get Boston not to take 2 years and spend $2 million to solve a problem that should be done in 3 months?
Procurement reform. And it's not something we're good at because it's essentially a lobbying problem.
The Iron Triangle.
And we desperately need some very good political players in this country who give a damn about procurement. And we're working on that. I don't think it's our core skill set. But procurement reform must happen in this country. And the least sexy possible thing in the universe. It's fundamental, and it's like killing us.
Sexy.
Huh?
I said seeing CPAC set naked is the least sexy thing you can think about.
Ew.
So I was really, really struck by that utterly unreadable letter that you put up on the screen, and the fact that you mentioned that you had to change policy before you were actually able to use text to contact those people. And I guess my question is, at the federal level, in terms of either procurement or maybe unnecessarily complex policies like FSMA or things like that, what do you see kind of driving the process towards very expensive companies who, you know, are maybe not giving us the best value?
Is the question, why do we end up contracting with companies who don't provide value?
Somewhat, but also what are the policies that, you know, infringe on that or, you know, stop that from happening in terms of, like, you know, is there a certain type or is it just procurement?
I think you're right to point at security. But I think in general, sort of the catchphrase, which is relatively accurate, is that these companies aren't evil. They're just playing the game that we created. And when I say we, who made government incredibly risk averse? The people did. We said to our politicians, we don't trust you, and so we're going to put in a whole bunch of safeguards to make sure that everything gets like checked 7,000 times and there's a whole bunch of process. And what that has evolved into is that there are companies that are very good at getting contracts and meeting government needs. And that is how the game is, that's how the deck is stacked, that's how the game is played. Of course those companies get the contracts. Again, this is not graft, it's just the way we've sort of set this game up. And so companies like CGI, who's the main contractor on healthcare.gov, are just really good at that. They aren't, unfortunately, good at the thing that we called out, which is meeting user needs. You know, does that make them bad? No. They've been doing what we have been telling them to do.
Is there any way to change those incentives, or is it just like people have to start speaking up and go from a grassroots level?
So a couple of concrete things that are changing. I mean, the security stuff is not, the dialogue around security is like completely crazy. It's just this like gun that you can point at somebody. So that's not fun. But that CIO playbook that I showed you, I pointed out number 4 said use agile iterative processes to build your software. What's backing that is something that the Office of Federal Procurement Policy put out. I spent months and months and months working with OFPP to explain to them why an agile process is not robbing the American people. Think about it. It's a natural conclusion. If you're supposed to know what you buy before you buy it, and that's how you protect the American taxpayer, agile's crazy and, like, you know, nuts. So, but the extremely long, like, several-year period of collecting requirements and then several-year period of delivering software, which makes many federal IT projects, you know, 6, 7, 8 years long and have a 94% failure rate, kind of speaks for itself at this point. Oh, God, that was loud. I'm sorry. The fact that they have published guidance, OFPP has now got published guidance that says that Agile is not only legal but preferred, and they show you how to do it using existing procurement policy, that's huge. That's a concrete change that's happened that will take us several years to actually come into practice. And there's a bunch of other things like that that are super nerdy and no one wants to talk about, but yeah, that's how these things will change.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for the question.
We have time for just one more question.
Okay. You guys have the best questions. You guys are awesome.
I've been developing software and writing code for several decades, and one of the things I noticed starting in the mid-90s was a change in the management theory, both in private, academic, and government circles, that you don't have to be a techie to manage techies. Mm-hmm. And one of the results of that has been kind of a disregard of institutional knowledge that developers have. And in the 90s and 2000s, tens of thousands of government software developers and programmers were laid off and replaced by outsourcing companies. And I saw that here in Seattle in King County. I worked for King County where they laid off 16 programmers in 98, which is a significant percentage, and then decided they had to outsource the work for the new the metro budget, which was supposed to cost $10 million and end up spending $130 million, and it's still not done.
Yep.
And every time I tell that to people, it's repeated all across the country, where long-term people who've been working for, you know, this is a career position for them, and they understand the data implicitly. When I spoke to a manager, I said, when I was called in as a contractor, I said, how do you know this data is right? And they said, well, we just, that's the computer guy, that's Norm, he's the one that does it. And I say to Norm, how do you know this data is right? And he goes, well, I just make sure that what they get out what they put in. And there's really a lack of understanding on the part of the non-techie managers about how important the technical people are. They seem to think of them as being replaceable. And I saw people coming in at $125 an hour, that's $250,000 a year, who are newbies. Mm-hmm. And they'd work for 6 months or a year, and then they'd be replaced by another bunch of newbies. And this is not something you can pick up. I mean, this takes years to understand how this data is related. It's very complicated.
Yeah.
And I don't really see how anything short of bringing this development stuff back in-house so that you can have, you know, a core group of people who understand the problem and are coding it rather than a group of people that are designing it, another group of people who are writing specifications, and another group of people maybe who are sleeping now and are going to wake up, you know, in a different time zone, who are going to write the code, and it's going to come back again. I just don't see that as being a sustainable way of developing software.
I agree with you. I think what you're saying, it really speaks to like what Tom Steinberg was saying, is we have just decided that technology is something we buy, not something we do, right? And maybe a different way of saying it is like digital services are how we communicate with, how we transact with the American public right now. And we've, as a country, have decided that we don't want to have, or had previously decided that we don't want to have an expertise in that. We don't have a capability in it, a competency in it. And that's been devastating. And I don't think we can fix the problem by pulling everything in-house right now. And even the UK, where they've moved a lot of stuff in-house, they still really worked on their vendor ecosystem, and they broke it up. And they have a map. It used to be like five big companies all in London. And now if you map their vendors, it's dots all over the map of the UK of smaller vendors. So they're still working on the vendor ecosystem, but they have the competence in-house to make good choices about vendors, to set policy, to set strategy, and to create a platform. They're really doing government as a platform because they've got smart people who know digital in-house. And we have to recognize that. We have to recognize digital as a core competence of government. That means having programmers in government. It means having a healthy ecosystem. And it's going to make a huge difference to the American people when we do that. Not if, when. Yeah. So great question. Thank you. And I think that's it. So thank you guys so much.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. If you value this episode or this series, please share your appreciation by posting a good review. It helps more people find us. Jennifer Palka is the founder and director of Code for America, a nonprofit organization that promotes technological solutions to government inefficiencies. She spoke at Town Hall Seattle on March 6, 2015. This talk was presented by Town Hall and University Bookstores, part of the Civic Series. Thanks to Edward Wolcher for our recording. For Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien. Thank you.